Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a look at how humans are adapting to the information revolution. My guest today says that humans have experienced three previous revolutions, are in the midst of the fourth. The first revelation was when Copernicus demonstrated that humans and Earth were not the center of the universe. The second one was when Darwin challenged our notion that man is the center of the biological kingdom on Earth. In fact, all life and species evolved. The third was that we were the masters of our own thoughts, but Sigmund Freud challenged that notion with the unconscious mind and defense mechanisms. Now the fourth revolution is at hand, one where human existence is based on information and reality can be virtual as well as physical. ICTs, information and communication technology, surround us every waking moment. New ones are being invented every day. How we interact to this flood of information and technology and adapt to it is the subject of the book, The Fourth Revolution, How the Infosphere is Reshaping Human Reality. My guest today is author Luciano Floridi, a professor of philosophy and the ethics of information at the University of Oxford, where he's also a senior research fellow at the Oxford Internet Institute. He's the author of The Ethics of Information and several other books on information technology. He's received numerous awards for his work, including the American Philosophical Association's Barwise Prize for contributions to the intersection of philosophy and technology. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Luciano Floridi, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hello. Hi, Rich. How are you?
I'm very well. Your book, The Fourth Revolution, gets into this whole idea of how we govern ourselves, how humans are going to react. I would like to focus, because it's such a big book, on how humans are reacting to what you call this fourth revolution. I've really been struck in the last few years as people are studying what I call digital natives. I think you refer to them as Generation Z. These are people who have grown up with digital and information and communication technologies through their whole life, internet, Facebook, everything. And neuroscientists are noting profound changes in our neural pathways. Behavioralists are noting changes in the way interpersonal relationships are taking place. Are these ICTs changing who we are as human beings?
They are. You're completely right. We need to understand a couple of things on top of that. Otherwise, we get too scared, as you were. On the one hand, we're very plastic. Now, you know, we human beings, they're amazing, all of us, because we adapt so easily. We change ourselves to circumstances. You know, there's a particular sport, we start excelling at that sport. There's a task, and you change until you get it right. So there's a lot of malleable potential nature in human beings. And, you know, you expose all of us to new technologies, and guess what you get? I mean, a lot of adaptation, changes, improvements. So it is important to realize what technologies are doing to us. At the same time, it's important to keep a perspective. I mean, this is not unusual. It's something that we do all the time. We are the adaptive entities in the world, you know, by definition. So that's important. And we also need to remember that depending on what you put ourselves in front of, well, we will adapt to that. So let's get the technologies right, because we will adapt to those technologies. This is quite crucial. And that's the first point that we need to keep in mind. The other thing is that it's also a loop, a feedback. Now, we adapt to technologies, but we also have some kind of desires, instincts. We want to get that particular product and not another. So technologies adapt to us. So you keep all together these ingredients. Now, we adapt, they adapt to us, we're very malleable, and you can see how dynamic the whole system is, to the extent that, you know, if you just look at the technology 10 years ago, it's unrecognizable, and so our habits, you know, the new generation is already very different from anything that probably you and I experienced when we were kids.
Yeah, you show a number of graphs which show how quickly information technology is changing. They're straight 45-degree angles up or 45-degree angles down. And I'm thinking of two figures in particular, which shows the average computing power in transistors. It's a straight V curve up, doubling every 2 years. The cost, on the other hand, is a V curve downwards, in which it's straight 45-degree angle, as the cost of a given amount of technology is going down.
Yeah, it is staggering. And anyone who is not amazed and a little bit concerned as well, is not getting it. I mean, it's the view that things have been changing so rapidly, so profoundly, that, of course, it's a new world. And, you know, it takes a little bit of reflection sometimes. You know, intelligent people think, okay, maybe it's just me, I feel important. Every generation feels it's unique, it's on the verge of a revolution. Just because we are around, it doesn't mean that we are so special. That's the first line of reasoning. And then sometimes you are in Paris or in Boston and it is a revolution. So we also have to consider the second stage and say, you know what, yes, in general, no, every generation feels special, but some generations are indeed special. And I think we are in the sense of having witnessed a revolution in this kind of technologies that is unprecedented and is actually setting the pace and the new perspective for future generations. Now, the things that, say, people alive today have witnessed from, you know, going from no TV in the house to black and white to color TV to your smartphone and video on YouTube, now, this is something that no future generations will experience as far as, you know, IT is concerned. So it is a privilege to be now at this particular stage, but it was also a bit disconcerting. It's all new, and now, the fact that we have more computational power in a ordinary car than we had when we put the first man on the moon,
yeah,
that's amazing. And of course, you know, people wonder, well, what do we do with all this power? What do we do with all this, you know, computational cheap, quote-unquote, energy that we are generating? And the truth is that we are transforming the world, and as we said before, ourselves with the world, by making everything interactive, easily accessible. It takes an enormous computational power to do all those touchy things that you do on a screen. So that's where all the computational power is going. So back to your point, it is a revolution. We better acknowledge that it is a revolution so we can deal with it intelligently.
Now, I want to touch on something you mentioned. You said that this generation is living through something that future generations won't. And I just wonder if this is the new reality of the speeding up of technology. When you think of Gutenberg's printing press, it took 100 years or more for it to gain acceptance. When you look at, say, the electrification of the first world, if you will, it was, 30, 40 years. When you look at how television took over, it was, from the first model to everybody having a television, it was maybe 10 or 15 years. CDs took maybe 5 or 6 or 7 years to replace LP albums. Everything's getting faster. Now you're looking at new technologies that are out 18 months ago that everybody has.
Yeah, I mean, so this particular pace that you nicely described, and correctly so, this is something that we, again, haven't witnessed in the past. So one way of kind of thinking about this is look at parents and children and look at who is teaching what to whom. My dad taught me how to drive.
Right.
Because, of course, the car industry, the car sort of generation was very well established. I mean, he learned from his dad and I learned from him. And, you know, that's the way it goes. But I had to teach him how to use a smart tablet. And that's because, you know, it goes reverse. So when the new generation teaches the previous generation the new technology, then you know that this is, you know, basically breaking the pace. Now, this, again, is nothing extraordinary. Someone had to teach someone else how to use a car, and, you know, probably my grandfather, whatever, had to learn from his son how to drive the car for the first time. So there's always a disruption in a generational gap that, you know, is linked to a new technology. But what we are witnessing today is the pace, and pace is power. I mean, it's not just a matter of quantity, it becomes a matter of quality. Now, once you start talking about objects, as you did, you know, recently in one of your programs, about, mm-hmm, you know, intelligent objects reacting to your, even anticipating your wishes, your smartphone that reminds you about some shopping that you don't even have to do, you just have to remind the fridge to do it. And so, well, once we have an interactive reality around us, well, that is, again, the sort of pace that is transforming itself into power, is quantity that becomes quality, and we have reached that sort of rhythm that you were mentioning at the beginning of our conversation. The pace is there, and it's pointless to think that it's going to slow down. It won't.
And there's a term for that. It's hyperhistory. We had prehistory before we had written accounts, and we're probably witnessing the end of prehistory in the next few years when the last few indigenous tribes in the Amazon or very remote areas start writing things down. Then we have history, which is when we begin writing things down, and now we have hyperhistory, which increasingly it looks like the industrialized world is a part of.
Yeah, this label, which I thought was helpful to make sense of the reality in which we live, it looks at basically human life on Earth from the perspective of how much we depend on our technologies. And in the past, prehistory or prehistorical societies, basically you cannot improve because you have no way of transmitting memory from the past to the future. I mean, everything is about leaving memory, but if something is forgotten, it's gone forever. I mean, there's no way of recording the past. Then we have, about 6,000 years ago, we started recording the past for future consumption, and all of a sudden you have education, you have improvement, you have things learned and not transmitted to future generations. You don't have to reinvent the wheel because someone is actually telling you how to make a wheel. And there's a connection there, say the Roman Empire or the British Empire, between information technology of one kind or another and the organization of a society. I mean, you can organize a bigger and bigger society only because you have laws, you have instructions, you have way of sending a message from here to there. And then recently we have moved into a context where our dependency on these information technologies is enormous. In other words, we can improve, we can move ahead, we can add value to what we do, we can live better, our society can improve its welfare, and so on, only insofar as our technologies, information technologies, are helping us. So we depend entirely on information technologies to go ahead. That dependency becomes something of a new age in our life as species on this planet. And that's why I thought that hyperhistory as a sort of a reinforced history, not just a matter of connection with information technology, but dependency on information technologies becomes vital. And if someone is just a bit skeptical and thinks, oh, this is all nice philosophy but not practicality, just think about the following point. If you live in a hyper-historical society, that means that your society can be threatened by cyber attacks. And immediately that you guys in the U.S., we in the U.K., we live in hyper-historical societies. We are so dependent on these technologies that we can be harmed by attacks that target those technologies. Then you have switched to a new world, that you depend on these technologies 100%.
You had a very sobering thought at the end of that section where you said, it's very sobering to think that the average hard drive lasts 5 years. A recorded CD, once it's recorded, although it was supposed to last 20, 25 years, it's turning out most of the time you're seeing corruption after 5 or 10 years. That's kind of scary. That kind of has a strange parallel to prehistory.
It does. Very good point. And I think it's a good reminder because we are so overwhelmed by data of all kinds, the so-called big data, and then governments with open data, and of course recordings of all kinds, and our apps following us everywhere, etc., that sometimes we forget that just because memory is so vast now, in fact, immensely vaster than anything has ever been experienced in the past, then is also very robust. It isn't. It's a very, very fragile, huge castle. And the fragility is reminded to us painfully whenever we have a piece of malware in our computer, boom, you lose the whole hard disk. When my mom moved accidentally, and she actually, as a matter of fact, she pressed the wrong button and deleted a whole 5 years of pictures from her hard disk, no backup, and they are gone. And she was devastated. And of course, she blamed the technology. I blame her because she should not have pressed that button. But on the other hand, do you really want to delete everything? And you go, yes, and that's it. So malware, delete, the possibility of having these supports, physical supports anyway, so they become unreadable after a few years, etc. I mean, all these signs that should remind us that we're building the future on a very delicate, fragile foundations. It is not a pessimistic thought. It's just a warning that we should be careful. So last time you moved all your LPs to CDs. I hope you didn't throw away those nice LPs because they're still payable. Whereas those CDs, if you did that 10 years ago, they're probably gone.
Oh, gosh. My guest today is Luciano Floridi. He's a professor of philosophy and ethics of information at Oxford University and a senior research fellow at the Oxford Internet Institute. His new book is titled The Fourth Revolution, How the Infosphere is Reshaping Human Reality. It's published by Oxford University Press, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I want to talk about how we're reacting, how humans are reacting to all this information. But before, I think we ought to explain what the fourth revolution is. The first revolution was the Copernican Revolution, where we realized that the Earth was not the center of the universe. The second was that humans weren't the masters of the Earth. We were an evolved species. The third was the Freudian Revolution, if you will, about the mind. And what is, and explain the fourth.
So these revolutions are all about science making a difference in our self-understanding. You get a scientific discovery or a scientific insight, and all of a sudden that puts a mirror in front of us and says, oh, wow, there's something changed in the way we see ourselves. And I believe that what everybody feels down the road on an everyday basis, this sense of, wow, something really is changing, something is not right, not normal, not business as usual, it's a revolution, but when we try to point out what kind of revolution it is, a lot of us used to get lost. They say, oh, it's because we can communicate faster. Well, that's not a big deal. Or we, now I can see, say, people on the screen and talk to them. Well, that's not really a big deal either, and et cetera. Until you realize that, you know what is really changing is not just what we can do with the world, but what that is doing to us. How is that changing our self-understanding? And then you realize, oh, so that's the big deal. Not only this fourth revolution, the computer science, the information technology revolution, is making a big difference in what we can do and how we can interact with each other and how we can take advantage, if you want, of the resources in the world, but it's also deeply affecting how we conceive of ourselves, who we are, and what we can be, or how we can socialize. Now, that is way more significant than any faster broadband or mobile phone connectivity or of invention or a 3D printer or anything else. It's not about Google. It's not about Facebook. It's not about Twitter. It's about us, who we think we are. And that's why I speak of this as a fourth revolution. The hero in this case is, of course, Alan Turing, the father of computer science, mm-hmm. as we know it today. And it's a way of understanding why all this technology and computer science is really transforming our view of what humanity is and can become.
Now, this was one of the most fascinating parts of the book, which is how we explain how our behavior is changing due to all of this technology and computing. And this is a little long, so bear with me. But you write in the book about how at one point an object that was created was unique and still can be when it's a handcrafted item. It's a unique item. But with the Industrial Revolution, we went to mass production, industrially produced identical objects. And we went from seeing an object as an individual item, a chair handcrafted to a mass-produced chair, so it doesn't matter which chair I have. And you say that ICT, information and communication technologies, have the ability to kind of reduce humans to a type, a category of consumer, of behavior, of, the list of categories are endless. And you said that humans, in many ways, are reacting the way about themselves the same way we reacted to mass-produced products, which is when you have a mass-produced product, you personalize it, you customize it to make it your own, whether it's a bumper sticker on a car or whatever. There's something to personalize that experience. And you write that in many ways, this is what we're doing with our internet technology. We're sort of rebelling against becoming a type.
We are. And I'd like to invite everybody with us to run for a moment just an experiment. Just look around you right now and look at the things that are surrounding you and then think for a moment that they have all been replaced by copies. You wouldn't know they are not the same things. Now, that pen, that computer, that mug, that desk, you can tell I'm in my office, that particular door, that jacket, they're all mass-produced. It means that to an enormous extent, they are identical to other objects. If I had been away for a week and I walked back into my room and every book on the shelves of my office had been replaced by identical copies, I probably wouldn't know, unless I put a mark on those copies, unless my computer has a little scratch because I don't know, bump into it, or unless that piece of paper has a scribble, which I made. So unless I personalize those anonymous entities. Now, the point that you were making, which I try to explain in the book, is that when it comes to us as entities, objects in the world, well, information technology treats us as replaceable things. What matters is that there's a customer there that can buy the product. I don't care if it is Mary, John, Peter, or anyone else. As long as someone is going to buy that product, I'm happy. So, myself, I'm no longer someone, an individual, special, whatever, but I am, say, a Volkswagen driver. I am someone who takes holidays in those particular corners of the world or likes, say, Indian food. In other words, I am just a type of person which is an intersection of a lot of lines of types of customers. So I'm cataloged as that kind of customer, their age, their income, lives in that particular corner of the world, etc. Now, we feel that way. And that's why, for example, on Facebook or any social media, we try to reappropriate our individual profile, which is like shouting, look, I'm not just anybody. It's me, capital M, capital E. And to be me, I have to show that I'm different from anyone else, which means sharing personal information, my deepest feelings and fears, what I did yesterday and what I had for breakfast this morning, etc. Now, that comes back to bite us because, of course, all that sharing just feeds into the mechanism once again, and therefore we become the people who had that kind of breakfast. Yes, exactly. So it's a battle you cannot really win by providing more information about yourself in terms of profiling yourself differently. The more you share, the more your profile will be shared among other lines and types and so on. So there are different ways of doing this, but the instinctual, natural reaction and say, look, I cannot be so anonymous. In order to avoid anonymity, I have to share, which means breaching my privacy, providing more information, and therefore even more than before, sharing with everybody else in the world my profile. Well, that's what we are witnessing today everywhere, and that's why you are astonished by the number of details that mostly everybody is happy to share when it comes to online communication.
Well, there's still a big belief that, say, the generation who have, the digital natives, if you will, are spending far more time doing this than other generations, older generations. Is that just a sense of how they've been rewired by this and so that they're spending more time honing their identity than others because it's an unconscious need or desire?
I think there's a point in that, yes. They are spending way more time than other generations.
I mean, when you talk to that generation, they'll be the first to admit, we're kind of narcissistic.
Indeed. One thing that might be mentioned, was perhaps with an analogy, is that it's also the generation that has been provided with all these candies and with no sense of a diet. So out of metaphor, if you think of human beings, and we are communication animals, we're social animals. We like to talk, we like to exchange views, we like to be together. And, give to that special animal, the social animal, the ultimate weapon to socialize, and guess what's going to happen? It socializes a lot. unless there's someone who starts saying, look, we need to develop more of a diet in this respect. Otherwise, we all will become socially obese, if you see what I mean. We will just grow into blobs that constantly share every single detail of pointless experience online just for the sake of it, eating, as it were, digital candies all the time. Well, we're going to be in trouble. But I'm optimistic. I think as any generation that has never had the experience before, we are experimenting, we are not making mistakes, but we're also learning from what goes well and goes wrong. And I think that in a short while, something that I would be surprised if we didn't see it, the living generation didn't see it, I think we're going to have the experience of not a backlash, but a more moderate, more thoughtful, more reasonable approach to social media and online presence. Now, that would be welcome as far as I'm concerned. So basically, we spent millennia now starving, and now that there's food available, we are developing ways of being more careful about our diets. Likewise, now we've been starving of socialization for millennia. And now that we have the ultimate weapons, the social media, inevitably we are abusing them. But we will come back. We'll do better in a little while.
It's sort of it's like obesity then.
It is. It really is. I find that the analogy is very close. Information, sharing, communication is what is to the mind and our social lives, what food is for the body. And we just love to have as much as we can because we come from that kind of past. Evolution, which tells you, get in now because it may not be there tomorrow. Likewise, with socializing and so on, is take advantage of it as much as you can because that's what you like and it might not be available tomorrow. We know that Facebook will be there tomorrow. We can do that more slowly, more thoughtfully, and we will. I mean, with the usual exceptions, there are always some crazy people around, but on average, your ordinary person with some good sense, we will pass through this.
Well, there's also a fear that things are changing so fast that we evolutionarily can't keep up with the speed. We're not capable of adapting that quickly. You think there's anything to that?
I think so. I mean, in a way, we have managed to develop a set of technologies that are basically faster than us in developing than we are in adapting to them. So that is the state of play at the moment. Now, think of whether this is sustainable. It isn't. No, if we do not adapt, we will simply not take advantage of the technologies in question. So we will drag them to a more reasonable speed by simply failing to adapt. So inevitably, it's a bit like, imagine with an analogy, cars and their speed. And then we all became citizens of big towns. And guess what? You go 20 miles an hour anyway. cars could go a fantastic speed, but because it's everybody around and we all travel and we all know slowing down, we're not making much progress. So that's what I'm a bit more concerned about. In other words, that our inability to make the most of these technologies, to take advantage of all these wonderful discoveries and inventions that we have around us, will not lead to a gap between the technologies and ourselves. That's almost a contradiction in terms. But it will mean that we will not be able to exploit them as much as we could and we should. I'm thinking about big problems such as the environment or financial crisis or fundamentalisms and therefore culture, education, health, you name it. I mean, the world is full of opportunities to apply these technologies for better goals. If we are not going to do it, it's a little bit like being unable to sort out the traffic downtown. Shame on us. We could have done better. We could have thought about it earlier and planned things differently. So my main concern is not so much the gap between our adaptive capacities and the technologies in question, but about how little we will be able to take advantage of them if we do not think carefully about what they should be there for.
The name of the book is The Fourth Revolution. Luciano Floridi, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Luciano Floridi is a professor of philosophy and ethics of information at Oxford University and a senior research fellow at the Oxford Internet Institute. His book is titled The Fourth Revolution, How the Infosphere is Reshaping Human Reality. It's published by Oxford University Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.